let's call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Please let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, April 26, 2021, and also that we have a quorum present today. Our Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Keel, Vice Chair Machicki, and myself, Chairman Rebeck. I'd like to recognize Senator Olson joining us to hear his bill here in a bit. Staffing the committee today is Committee Aide Betty Tangeman, LIO Moderator Nate Williams, and Christopher Dickrell from Records. Thank you to you all for your service. Today's agenda consists of four new items: SB 110, Electric Utility Liability; SB 113, Extend Fishery Resource Land Tax Credit; and SB 125, Hunting Permits Transferability; SB 59, Saltwater Sport Fishing Operators Guides. We're going to try and just open most of these up. We'll look for the will of the committee maybe on one of them, but we're going to try and just open these up so we can dig into them again at a later date. We're going to start with SB 110, sponsored by Senator Machicki. If you guys could make your way up, we'll hear from Senator Machicki and Emmy Jackson, his aide. Please place yourselves on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Resources Committee. I appreciate you having us today. I'm Senator Peter Machicki from District O.
And for the record, Emmy Jackson, staff to Senator Machicki.
So thank you for having us up today. Senate Bill 110 is a subject we've discussed before, Mr. Chairman. And I don't believe it had a fair shot. And one of the reasons for that is I don't know that there was adequate discussion that heard from both sides of this issue while it was in committee. It ended up going to the floor, and then part of the discussion came up, and it was pulled back in the past. This, it was not my bill in the past. I'm carrying this for by request. But I will tell you that I think it's something we do have to discuss, and it's about liability of electric utilities when something happens that's beyond their control. So I'm going to hand it off to staff and come back up there, and I'll be available for questions as well. We have some folks on the phone today, Mr. Chairman, that I think it's a part of the discussion we've not yet heard. When a utility is impacted because of something like a forest fire, their liability is everyone's liability, right? Because we're all ratepayers. And when they don't have adequate protection for liability, sometimes their only choice is to de-energize a line, which impacts potentially a very large part of the ratepayers, the folks that depend on that power. And when there's an impact to liability, it impacts everyone's electric bill sort of equally. So I think it's a worthwhile discussion to have. I'm just hoping we can get these issues on the table, and we'll take it from there. So with that, I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'll come back up, sit in my seat, and we'll hand it off to Emmy Jackson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Please let the record reflect we've been joined by Senator Kawasaki. And Emmy, please place yourself on the record and go ahead and walk us through.
Yeah, for the record, Emmy Jackson, staff to Senator Machicki. Senate Bill 110 will protect Alaska's electric utility ratepayers from increased rates by clarifying in statute when electric utilities are and are not legally liable for damages caused by contact between vegetation and electric infrastructure. Under the provisions in Senate Bill 110, a utility would not be liable for damages caused by vegetation outside its easement coming in contact with electric facilities. For vegetation inside an easement, a utility would be liable for damages if the utility did not adhere to its vegetation management plan. To be clear, Senate Bill 110 does not eliminate all liability from electric utilities. Liability would still apply if a utility was found to have failed to follow its own vegetation management plan, or if a utility causes vegetation outside its easement to contact electric facilities. The legislation better defines in statute when damages are applicable, setting clear expectations that utilities will implement and follow vegetation management plans or face liability. Senate Bill 110 protects electric utilities from being held liable for the cost of damages caused by vegetation that they either cannot control or were not permitted to maintain. This also protects Alaska's electric ratepayers from having to bear the brunt of these costs through their rates in a state where electric utility service costs are already high. So thank you for your time and for hearing this bill, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I know we have quite a few folks online that we have to testify to.
Thank you. And maybe before we go into questions, we'll take some of those folks online. I think we have some experts. Okay, perfect. Yeah, we're going to go to the executive director of the Alaska Power Association. Crystal, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Crystal Inkthist, and I'm the executive director of Alaska Power Association. Andy Lehman, APA's general counsel, is available for questions. Alaska Power Association is the statewide association representing electric utilities in Alaska. Our members provide power to more than a half million Alaskans from Utqiagvik to Unalaska through the interior and south central and down the Inside Passage. APA strongly supports Senate Bill 110. Senate Bill 110 protects Alaska electric ratepayers from increased costs. It does that by providing clear rules about when utilities are liable for damage caused by vegetation, most commonly trees, getting too close to electric facilities. Utilities operate and maintain electric lines throughout Alaska. These lines are generally located in easements or rights of way across private and public property. Those easements and rights of way are generally just wide enough to accommodate the electric line itself and allow access for maintenance and repairs. Many are only 15 or 20 feet on either side of the power line. Wider easements would present bigger burdens for landowners and unnecessarily restrict other uses of the underlying property. Utilities clear or control vegetation inside these rights of way and easements to minimize the risk of contact with their facilities. Vegetation outside the boundaries of the easement or right-of-way can and does grow high enough that it could contact an electric utility's facilities. If a utility cuts trees outside its legal right-of-way, it could be forced to pay treble damages to the property owner. Vegetation outside these rights-of-way creates an uncontrollable risk from that vegetation potentially contacting electric facilities. Electric utility ratepayers should not have to pay for wildfires caused by vegetation beyond utility easements and rights-of-way. Senate Bill 110 makes it clear that utilities are only liable for vegetation outside their property lines if the utility itself causes the vegetation to hit the lines. Electric utilities have the right to control vegetation inside their property and easements, and they do. As you will hear in later testimony today, Alaska utilities already have comprehensive vegetation management plans tailored to their own unique circumstances. Senate Bill 110 sets clearer liability rules by providing that utilities are only liable for damages from vegetation inside the easement or right-of-way contacting their facilities if they didn't have a vegetation management plan or if they have a plan and don't follow it. It is worth reemphasizing, as Emmy Jackson said earlier, that Senate Bill 110 does not eliminate liability for electric utilities. They will still be liable if they are found to have failed to follow their own vegetation management plan or if the utility causes vegetation outside the right-of-way to contact its power lines or other electrical equipment. As factors that cause wildfires increase, hotter, drier summers, invasive insects, and longer growing seasons, it is imperative that Senate Bill 110 pass to protect Alaska electric utility ratepayers. Clear rules about when utilities are liable for vegetation issues are good for everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Crystal. I think we'll just move through. We have three more folks, and then we'll get to questions. Next, we're going to take Travis Million, Chief Executive Officer from Copper Valley Electric Association. Travis, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Travis Million, the CEO of Copper Valley Electric Association. I'm going to start today with a brief presentation that you have up on your screen to kind of give you an introduction to vegetation management and utility rights-of-way, and then I'll go into my formal testimony. If you can go to the next slide, Emmy. Vegetation management is our utility's legal obligation for running our lines and maintaining the vegetation within those boundaries. For us, the biggest thing is it provides our reliable electric service to our members. The vegetation that we're clearing, if not maintained, will come in contact with the lines and most likely create outages. The biggest thing as well is the ensuring the safety to the public, whether the tree comes in contact with the line that possibly caused a wildfire, or if that tree comes in the line, say for most cases in the state of Alaska during the wintertime, it could sag that line down to the ground and become a hazard for those who are driving on the right-of-ways on snow machines. Next slide, please. The next slide you see is a picture, just a graph showing a typical utility right-of-way. What you see in this picture is a pole with a cross arm, and the rights-of-way in this particular case, which is a distribution line, is 30 feet, and which is 15 feet from center line. So as the picture depicts, you have 15 feet from either side of the center of the pole, and typically when utilities put put the lines in, they try to center within their easement so you have equal distance from either side of the pole. The right-of-way is a legal right established by usage or grant for a utility to be in that area. The land is not owned by the utility, but it's owned either by state, federal, or private property owners, and it's giving the utility an easement or access to that particular land. So we don't own the land, and we cannot go outside of those easements legally. Typically, in utilities, our distribution lines will have anywhere from 20 to 30 feet easements based on the type of line that's ran. And transmission lines, which are the much larger lines that you see running anywhere from Homer all the way up to Fairbanks, in our case between Glen Allen and Valdez, will have up to 100-foot right-of-way in those areas. Next slide, please. So just briefly to go through some of the clearing methods that are used by utilities in the state of Alaska, we typically use mechanical means of clearing using chainsaws, and in the picture on the upper right is showing one of our linemen up in a bucket truck using a telescoping chainsaw in order to cut the limbs that are up in the trees that cannot be reached by the ground. These are typically the case where you have a tree that physically is located outside of the right-of-way, but the trees are encroaching our lines inside the right-of-way, so we have to get up into that tree using a bucket truck and cutting the limbs down that way. Next slide. For mechanical means of clearing vegetation, we particularly at Copper Valley Electric, and I know a number of other utilities in the state, also use the devices that are seen on the top two pictures of this slide. These are called sky trims, or also known as giraffes. They're a device that has a telescoping arm with basically a radial arm saw blade at the end that is able to reach the limbs of trees from the ground, and it telescopes up and cuts those limbs down. Part of our easement is we are allowed to clear the right-of-way ground to sky, so we can go vertical that 30 feet. But we can't necessarily take the trees that are outside of that 30-foot easement. The picture in the bottom left is showing a brush hog, or in our case, the brand name is a fecon. And that goes through, and all the branches that are left on the ground are mowed up by this, and it chips them up into very small chips and leaves them in the right-of-way. So once the right-of-way is cleared with that device, it's very clean on the ground. Next slide, please. This picture is looking at one of our transmission rights-of-way. The picture on the left is a very common scene that you'll see in between clearing. This particular area grows very fast. As you can see, it's very green, meaning it's typically very wet because it's near Valdez. In this case, this particular area is probably not as susceptible to wildfires because you have so much green vegetation and it's normally very wet. It's not a very dry condition. So wildfires are not the main concern here. It would be more concerns of trees coming across into the line coming in contact, and if anybody was going up and down the right-of-way coming in contact with those lines. The picture on the right shows our 100-foot-wide transmission right-of-way, cleared ground to sky. As you can see, everything is mulched down and cleaned up all the way to the ground level on this particular line. Next slide. This is just showing an example of a distribution line in this particular case. The picture on the left is showing the before of this line before we started clearing out the right-of-way. As you can see, the vegetation starts encroaching on the line just through normal growth periods in between our clearing cycles. The picture in the middle is showing our FECON or brush hog piece of equipment going through and mowing down the right-of-way and getting it all cleaned up. And the picture on the right is showing the final product. Again, this is a distribution line with a 30-foot right-of-way. Last slide, please. So this picture here is just showing a typical distribution line on our system after we have gone through and cleared the vegetation within our right-of-way. As you can see, looking down the edges of the right-of-way, the trees are cleared from the ground to the sky. You can see almost a straight line up and down to where any branches that would protrude into the right-of-way have been cleared and taken care of. What I want you to remember in this picture is if you look at any one of these trees in this picture, which are outside of our legal obligation to clear, any one of those trees could fall and make contact with our line without a problem. The problem you have is when you have trees that are 80 to 100 feet tall outside the right-of-way, but your poles and wires are only 45 to 50 feet off the ground, a tree from even 30 feet or 15 feet outside the right-of-way can easily come in contact with our lines. So that concludes my presentation, and if you're okay, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to go into my testimony.
Yes, please do.
Thank you. So again, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Travis Million, the CEO of Copper Valley Electric Association. We're an electrically isolated electric cooperative serving 3,800 members in the interior of Alaska. We're headquartered in Glen Allen and serve as far south as Valdez, north nearly 160 miles, and east to west 100 miles. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony on this bill. CVA strongly supports Senate Bill 110, which is mentioned by Ms. Inkvist. This bill would clarify in statute that an electric utility may not be held liable for property damage, death, or personal injury resulting from contact between vegetation outside a utility's rights-of-way and the utility infrastructure, thus protecting the ratepayers, which in most cases in Alaska are the member owners of an electric cooperative or the citizens of a municipality. Even prior to the news of the California wildfires, CVA has been very aggressive over the last 5 years to reestablish and maintain our rights-of-way. Not only is it our responsibility as the stewards of the utility rights-of-way, but it's the right thing to do. Maintaining the rights-of-way in Alaska can be very difficult work. In places like the Southeast and in Valdez, the trees and vegetation grow about as fast as you can get them cleared. CVA has developed a very comprehensive vegetation management plan, which describes the width of right-of-way that can be cleared for both distribution and transmission assets, the methods that are used in order to clear that right-of-way, both hand clearing and the use of mechanical equipment, such as brush mowers and the vertical clearing machines that I showed you in the presentation, and the rotation of which feeder or feeders will be cleared at any given year, and how frequently they'll need to be revisited. CVA's 106-mile-long transmission line has maintained a 100-foot-wide clearing through some of the most rugged terrain in Alaska, and we've reestablished nearly the entire length of this line since 2016. If a tree from outside the right-of-way were to come in contact with our lines and cause a fire, it does not seem right that the utility, which has an established plan and is doing their due diligence to maintain those rights-of-way, be held liable for the property damage caused by that tree when we do not have the legal right to remove it. Unlike many utilities in the lower 48, remotely isolated utilities run the risk of having to shut down the power system if a lawsuit were to bankrupt the utility. In most cases, there isn't another option to receive electrical services. Essentially, if the utility was sued, those who would be ultimately hurt by it would be the member owners, not the stakeholders like in a for-profit electric utility. Without the changes to the Alaska statute that are introduced in SB 110, it leaves very few cost-effective options for the utilities to mitigate these risks, again, without any cost burden being passed to our member owners. With increasingly warm summers in the interior of the state brings drier conditions, increased number of spruce beetle-killed trees, and higher risks of wildfires. I strongly urge you to consider passing SB 110 to protect the Alaska Electric Utilities and their member owners. Thank you again for hearing this bill, and that concludes my testimony.
Thanks, Travis. Do we have any questions for Travis? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks for being online today. The last slide that we are looking at is, it says right-of-way clearing, and you mentioned that there's trees that are maybe 80 feet tall, and those could hit the power line and be outside. Do you work with property owners if there's like leaning trees and things like that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kawasaki, through the chair. Yeah, we work our program to where we let our members know that if there are any trees that they see on their property that are what they would consider a danger tree or leaning toward our line, they can contact us and we'll go through and clear those trees for them without charge. And if we happen to be in the area and we see a tree that's dangerously close or leaning toward the line, we will work with the property owner to clear that tree. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll move on to John Burns, President and Chief Executive Officer of Golden Valley Electric Association. John, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the opportunity to testify this afternoon regarding Senate Bill 110. For the record, my name is John Burns, and I have the privilege of serving as Golden Valley Electric Association's CEO. Golden Valley is a not-for-profit electric cooperative serving interior Alaska communities and residents from Cantwell to Delta Junction, including Fairbanks and North Pole. We have a service area that encompasses 5,973 square miles. Within our service area, GVA has approximately 2,600 miles of right-of-way easements that we are responsible to clear on a rotating seven-year cycle, clearing an average of 370 miles every season, consistent with our vegetative management plan. GVA spends approximately $3 million annually on our right-of-way clearing efforts. I'd like to compliment Mr. Million on a great presentation. The 101 management PowerPoint that he provides, I think it really illustrates the operational concerns that certainly Golden Valley shares. Senate Bill 110 is vitally important to protecting not only the residents and interests of GVA's ratepayers, but so too the interests of all of Alaska's electric ratepayers from increased costs associated with the risk of wildfire and other damages caused by vegetation that is outside our right-of-way easements and over which GVA and the other utilities have absolutely no control. GVA has some of the highest electric rates within the rail belt, in large measure due to the nature of our generation units. High rates are not something we are proud of, and I can absolutely assure you that they are something that we are ever vigilant in trying to control. I can also assure you that lawsuits for damages caused by vegetation that is outside of GVA's right-of-way and outside of GVA's ability or right to control would further raise costs to our ratepayers. Senate Bill 110 is important to protect GVA ratepayers and all electric ratepayers from bearing additional costs resulting from lawsuits related to forces that are outside a utility's control. As you heard earlier from APA and Mr. Million, electric utilities are not allowed to enter property that is outside our legal right-of-way without the consent of the property owner. To do so exposes a utility to liability for trespass. It stands to reason, therefore, that utilities should not be liable for that which we do not control. It is neither fair nor just to impose liability on an electric utility for damage caused by vegetation from outside the right-of-way that falls into or otherwise contacts our electric infrastructure. Senate Bill 110 makes clear in statute that electric utilities would not be liable for damage caused by vegetation outside its easement contacting electric facilities. For vegetation that is inside an easement, a utility would only be liable if the utility did not adhere to its vegetation management plan. SB 110 does not, and I think this is very important, does not eliminate liability to electric utilities. Rather, SB 110 makes it very clear that as to when liability applies and when it does not apply to electric utilities, when damage arises from vegetation contacting electric infrastructure. For Golden Valley, what we are finding is that the climatic changes that we are having to deal with, and for those of you who have spent any time in the interior, you know that the exponential growth rate on trees, the birches and the aspens, compounded with freezing rain sometimes in the winter, heavy snows and high winds, has really exacerbated the challenges that we are facing. And oftentimes we get what's called rainbow trees. These are trees that are outside of the right-of-way that because of conditions, whether it be rain or, you know, freezing rain or heavy snows, they end up bowing and coming into our rights of way in contacting the our infrastructure, and it's really creating significant problems. Also, in the summer, with the exception of last year, I'll say, you know, our summers have been very, very dry, and that compounds the concerns. So I would really urge passage of SB 110 as a basis to provide that modicum of protection to utilities that are very critical, in particularly in this very litigious environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to Jim Butler from Homer Electric Association. Jim, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some comments today. Again, for the record, my name is Jim Butler. I'm counsel with HEA, Homer Electric, Baldwin and Butler, and also work with an incident management consulting firm. I'll try to refrain from going over what you've already heard. I think the previous testimony outlines very well the rationale and the importance of SB 110, and I appreciate the opportunity to perhaps share a couple of other comments. Just by way of background briefly, with Homer Electric Association, like many of the other utilities, it's a nonprofit that was founded in 1945. It's governed, and I think this is important to understand, it's governed by a board of directors that are elected and held accountable by the paying members. The service area is from east of Sterling, north to Nikiski, down to Kachemak Bay and across Kachemak Bay for those communities, spanning just over 3,160 miles, almost 3,200 miles. That represents 24,338 member owners of the utility. Now, I have to confess, I am not a person who is a utility person by background, so I would defer to some of the expertise. But one thing that I've found as I've learned about it more is the distinction between distribution lines and transmission lines. And I think those are important because when you start to manage issues like vegetation, how distribution and transmission lines are worked with within the utility are somewhat important. In Homer Electric's case, we have just over 2,700 miles of energized line. That's just about 1,400 miles of overhead distribution lines, about 1,000 of those underground lines or distribution lines, and we have 300 miles of transmission lines. Now, why that distinction is important is distribution lines, as you might guess, distribute the electricity to the consumers, and those are the lines you typically see around your neighborhood and overhead in town. The transmission lines are the ones you probably see more likely when you're on the highway going to and from communities. The landowners are, in most cases, different. With distribution lines, you're dealing most frequently with homeowners or people who have, let's say, a little bit different connection to the property and their interest in the vegetation than the transmission lines. In the case of HEA, a lot of our transmission lines, while some are over private property, many are over public property, which would be with the state of Alaska or with the federal government and the wildlife refuge. Shifting briefly just to HEA's right-of-way management plan, we look at it, we consider it a right-of-way management plan. We've had one of those for many, many years. And like you heard from the other, we value the input of the consumers and members that we're working around, the landowners, when we're in the process of clearing those. So we maintain a combined of a little over 1,500 miles, and those are cleared certainly for the safety, maintaining and preventing hazards to the extent possible and damage to the facilities. But more importantly, it's also very important for the safety of crews so that they can quickly and efficiently get in and access lines that might be down with seasonal weather events or for some other cause. So in addition to making sure that the facilities aren't damaged by falling vegetation, we also want to make sure people can get in safely and restore power to the consumer as quickly as possible. One thing that I think is important is that members, at least in the instance of HEA, and I heard from Copper Valley, I'm sure in Fairbanks, we notify our members that when we're in an area clearing, and we find that more frequently with the infestation of the beetles and spruce bark beetle kills, we've got more people interested in having support in that regard. However, what we are not in the business of doing is going up and down the right-of-ways looking for trees that could be a problem. I mean, we expect to work collaboratively with landowners, but the utilities are not in a position to take the place of the responsibility that landowners have for monitoring and managing any potential hazard trees that come up on their properties. One of the things we haven't heard much about, but I think it's important, is the cost associated with maintaining a right-of-way program. Each year, HEA spends just over $1.2 million to implement its plan, and that involves any ranging from $1.2 million to $1.6 million, depending upon the area they're working in. And that's an investment that comes out of the members' pockets and is something that is supported by the board of directors when they approve the annual budget and get briefed on where the priority is in different regions of the service area, principally where either it's time to go in over a 5 to 7 year or we have reports of an outbreak of spruce bark beetles that are becoming a hazard. I'd like to echo the reasons that the other who have testified support this bill, but I'd also like to add one point that I don't think I've heard yet, and that is that the bill provides an incentive for utilities to adapt best practices and essentially develop these right-of-way management programs unique to their particular service areas. We heard the difference between Fairbanks, Valdez, and the Kenai Peninsula. But we want to try to incentivize the utilities and having these plans and making sure that they're afforded some protection by following them, but also hopefully incentivizing the landowners to also be aware that this is a shared responsibility to make sure that the facilities are safe and that we don't have indirect damages or costs associated. Finally, I think it's important to understand that while we hear a lot about liability, I'm not a litigator by trade, but I've been around enough of litigation to know it's not so much the liability, it's the arguing about the liability. And when a forest fire occurs or around a power line, it's pretty common for the utility to be looked at as a potential source. And there can be significant arguments about how that fire may or may not have started. And when that occurs, whether or not the utility is liable, because they are often seen as a deep pocket, they incur significant expenses to deal with defending those claims. And I'd like to echo the other folks who've testified. We would like to just clarify those rules of engagement, incentivize best practices, and continue to work successfully with our member customers to make sure we're mitigating the hazards, not just for fire, but also for people who enjoy our right-of-ways during the winter. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll end my comments. Appreciate the opportunity, and we'd be glad to be available for any questions for you or anybody on the committee. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Next, we're going to go we're going to open public testimony. It looks like we have one testifier, and then we're going to open it up to questions. Public testimony is now open. and Lynn Elliott. If you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony for SB 110.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lynn Elliott. I'm the Assistant Vice President of State Government Relations for American Property Casualty Insurance Association, also known as APCIA. APCIA represents about 50% of Alaska's property casualty insurance market and represent all sizes, structures, and regions. Families, communities, and businesses across the state of Alaska purchase policies from APCIA members. I just want to say we appreciate the importance of states having robust policies on wildfire and mitigation practices. Particularly, as was mentioned, all over the West, we are having warmer, drier summers, and we appreciate that the uniqueness of a state that is as large and diverse as Alaska. However, APCIA does have a primary concern with Senate Bill 110. Currently, Alaska has no state standards for vegetation management plans. APCIA is concerned about granting immunity with no specified standards for these plans. We see a need for compliance with state vegetation management plan standards as a condition for partial immunity. In short, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to see a proper balance in state policy that takes into account the needs of the utilities, the property owners, and the insurers. We don't think Senate Bill 110 quite gets there. And with that, thank you for the opportunity to provide a few remarks today.
Thank you, Lynn. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none and no more online, we're going to close public testimony. All right, now we're going to hold this bill, but before we move on to the next item on today's agenda, does anybody have, we also have the Alaska Power Association, their general counsel, Mr. Andy Lehman, and Crystal still online. Do any committee members have any questions before we move on? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Ms. Elliott covered my biggest question, which is what defines a vegetation management plan? We want to make sure that it's robust, I think, and I can't really think of a state entity that looks at those today. So I'd be particularly interested in the sponsor or maybe one of the utilities' notions for what those standards might look like. If Ms. Elliott's on the line, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, it'd be good to know if the bill were to pass and the wind blows a tree down. Is that something that homeowners insurance would generally cover if your house burns in that fire, or does that leave the property owner uncovered without the utility to look to?
Yes, Mr. Lehman, if you're online, maybe you'd be a good person to answer that.
Thank you. Through the chair. I'm certainly not an insurance expert, but my understanding would be that, yeah, in general, that's why you have homeowners or property insurance, is to cover damages caused by fires, whether those fires were caused by vegetation contacting a power line or by a lightning strike or, you know, a campfire that got out of control. There's a bunch of different causes that can lead to a fire.
Thank you, Andy, and maybe Lynn Elliott. Lynn, do you want to address that? Did you hear the question? Please put yourself back on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Lynn Elliott with American Property Casualty Insurance Association. The answer is probably a little bit longer, but the short answer is yes, insurance policies are generally there to protect the homeowner or the business owner in the event of loss. And one of the concerns as it relates to having lack of a standard around a vegetation management plan or a state entity that has the ability to review those is insurers being concerned that they could lose their subrogation rights under Senate Bill 110, which is basically their ability to recover costs on behalf of those homeowners or those property owners. who are insured by insurance companies.
All right, thank you. We have a question from Senator Kawasaki. Okay.
One more.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other question, and we just happen to have a former attorney general on the line. Mr. Burns might be the way to go, but at your discretion, had to do with that subrogation question. I represent an area where there are a lot of steep hillsides and the trees grow pretty tall. Oftentimes those steep hillsides are state land. So if the property owner where the tree has its roots, I guess the question is, do we risk creating a situation where the property owner where the tree has its roots is the one who's on the hook then? And in my estimation here, I've got a lot of state land where that might be the case.
Mr. Burns, if you're still online.
Yes, I am. When you think about it from a property owner's perspective currently, the property owner has a responsibility to maintain their property. And so, therefore, to the extent that a tree, just use my neighbors, for example. I had a tree that on my property that fell across and hit my neighbor's fence, and I was responsible for that, and so that remains the same. What this bill is seeking to do, and that's what Mr. Butler raised, was really one of the biggest points here. What Ms. Elliott had indicated is this right of subrogation is where the morass happens. Okay, from the standpoint is that the tree falls into the line, and there's damage that occurs. It falls from outside, damage occurs, and the homeowner would typically be responsible for that which is on their land. And where our concern from the utility's perspective is that then we get sucked into having to defend against a situation where we had no control over to begin with. So this is not shifting liability to a property owner. The property owner already has responsibility to maintain their own property. This is just making very clear the circumstances under which a utility would have liability, and makes clear also where the utility does not have liability. It's a clear demarcation.
Thank you. Senator Michicki.
Just kind of interesting. I'm a property owner of some residential rentals, and a tree fell, windstorm, healthy tree. I won't make any no one heard it jokes, but pretty densely forested little area. And my insurance company informed me that it was an act of God that was not covered. And I did some settlement on my own, even though they made it quite clear that they would go to my defense that I was not responsible for that tree. So, again, this is the way that I view this bill. This bill is only clarifying what a utility is responsible for when it's beyond their control. And if you think about that at home, you simply can't be responsible for something that you can't control, and so in the condition of a tree that is dead and a potential nuisance, you can contact the owner and say, you have a beetle kill 90 footer near the power line, we're worried about it. They are clearly responsible for that if they don't take care of it. When you've got hundreds and hundreds of miles of that situation, it becomes a little bit more difficult. But I think, for me, this is a fairness issue, and I wanted to bring it up today. I plan to reach out to Ms. Elliott and the others that we heard from today to try to find a solution. She made the comment that this bill doesn't get there, but I'd like to know exactly what her view is of fairness. And I think that's where the bill sort of got kind of ambushed last time, as you start thinking, wait a minute, I don't want to impact my homeowners on their insurance because of this sort of thing. But you de-energize a line in the middle of winter because you're worried about that kind of interaction, and there could be thousands of ratepayers that are impacted trying to keep a home warm when there's no power to the house while they're dealing with the situation. So either way, it's going to impact homeowners. Either way, it's potentially impacting casualty insurance companies, property and casualty insurance companies. So we're, in your case, you're asking about one homeowner. In my case, I'm trying to find a solution for potentially thousands, as well as a fair solution for utility companies as well. So I don't know if there's any more questions today, but I plan to go back to the others to try to find a solution and actually get something across the finish line that not only protects property owners, but the utility companies as well in a fair manner.
Well, thank you, Senator Michicki, and we will set this bill aside so we can have those conversations and take this up at a date in the future. Next on the agenda is SB 125, Hunting Permits Transferability, sponsored by Senator Von Imhoff. If you could, Senator Von Imhoff, whether you'd like to stay right there or at, whatever makes you comfortable, please put yourself on the record and begin. Oh, wait.
Okay, thank you. So this is Senator Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm here to present Senate Bill 125. And then I have my staff member, Inti Harbison, who will be continuing. So this came about due to a young man named Chase Bowerson. He was an avid hunter and an outdoorsman. He was also a constituent of mine. And in December of 2020, Chase put in for a 2021 moose tag. And on January 2nd of this year, at only 26 years old, Chase was killed by an acquaintance. Chase was subsequently awarded that moose tag about a month after he was killed. Chase's mom and his executor of his estate contacted Fish and Game to let them know that he was deceased. She did ask to transfer the tag to a proxy hunter, such as an immediate family member, to take the hunt on his behalf. His family, they're a very long-time hunting family, and they wanted to do the hunt in Chase's honor. But the request was denied by the Fish and Game. While the department was very sympathetic, their hands were tied, and current statute does not allow for a proxy in these kind of situations. So I feel the statute needs to be changed, and that's why we're here today.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Next, we'll hear from Senator Von Imhoff's aide. Please put yourself on the record and begin.
Through the chair, for the record, Inti Maya Harbison, staff to Senator Von Imhoff. Senate Bill 125 would allow for a hunting permit awarded by drawing to be transferred to another qualified hunter should the original permit holder die before completing the hunt. It is the intent of this bill to put an end to the trauma faced by many families when, after having lost a family member, they are further denied rights for which their deceased family member applied for, paid for, and were awarded. This bill pertains exclusively to the transfer of draw hunting permits and would not impact any other license, tag, or sport fishing vessel registration.
Thank you, Mr. Harbison. Do we have any committee questions at this time?
Just one.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harbison or Senator, any particular reason you didn't also include registration permits in Tier 1 permits?
For the record, Inti Maya Harbison, staff to Senator Vine Hoff. Senator Keel, the way that this bill was put together was specifically to address this issue that does not allow for the draw permit tags to be transferred between somebody who has been deceased and a proxy.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
Senator Keel, describe what you just stated. So what is it that we didn't add that you're interested in?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Brimhoff, I was, I guess actually Tier 1 permits would be the ones that would be awarded in advance. Registration permits are generally applied for closer to the hunt and might not be applicable. Just wanted to I was curious whether you'd thought about the universe of other situations where someone might pass away.
So thank you. I think that when we had a brief conversation with Fish and Game, this is what they recommended. From what I understand, generally permits in this particular aspect are applied the year before, like December, then they're awarded early in the year, and then usually the hunt begins in usually August or September or thereafter. So there is a span of when a person could potentially pass away. If you feel, though, that sort of registration permits, I don't know enough information, but if you'd like, I can look into it and see if it makes sense to fold that into this bill.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we will move on. I'm sorry, did you have? Yes, please.
Through the chair into Mara Harbison again. I believe we do have Fish and Game on the line, if that question would be better directed towards them.
Okay, Natalie Weber from Fish and Game, could you please put yourself on the record? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Natalie Weber with the Division of Wildlife Conservation. And I believe the question was, and please correct me if I misunderstood, the question was why nothing else was included in this bill, any of the other types of permits or such. And it's my understanding that we were asked if the bill covered the intent of the drawing permits only. And the answer to that question was yes. Perhaps Ms. Hanke with the Division of, with the Department of Fish and Game is also with us. I believe she coordinated more closely with the Senator's office on the development of this bill.
Thank you. Ms. Hanke, if you could please put yourself on the record.
For the record, Rachel Hanke, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. When we were looking at this legislation, we were trying to solve, you know, the constituent issue at hand, and that was for drawing permit only. We have not discussed including other types of registration permits. But yes, if that's something that the committee is interested in looking at, we can look into that as well.
Thank you. Okay, next we're going to move on to public testimony. Public testimony is now open on SB 125. We'll start with Wei Bowerson. Wei, could you please put yourself on the record and begin?
Hi, Wei Bowerson. I'm a lifelong Alaskan living in Anchorage. I'm calling in support of SB 125. As someone who was directly affected by it, I just completely want to make sure that, you know, no other family has to go through the same kind of trauma. It's like right after you go through that kind of a traumatic experience, it's another shot in the back a month later or 6 months later, however long it might be. And, you know, for someone in our family, you know, we might be more fortunate, but a lot of people do depend on subsistence hunting in this state, and to take that away from them along with a family member is completely unjust, in my opinion. I think the reason that we were kind of focusing on the draw tags is they are a lot up in the air rather than just registering for a hunt. So I just wanted to say that as well. My brothers, myself, my father, we all registered for these same hunts, and my brother who was murdered was the one who drew it. None of us else drew. So that was kind of the issue at hand, is a lot. We enter every year. Most families enter every year, and only a handful of people actually get them. So it just happened that he was the one who got it. And the more we looked into it, this happens to a lot of Alaskan families. So, that's all I had to say.
Thank you, Wei, and thank you for your willingness and your time to be here to testify. Please accept the deepest sympathies from the Senate Resources Committee, and thank you again for being here to testify.
Thank you.
Next, we'll move on to Danielle Campbell-Moore. Danielle, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Hi, thank you so much again. For the record, my name is Danielle Campamore. Chase Bowerson is my cousin. I come from this in a very different angle than what you're going to hear from the rest of my family members. They had the privilege of knowing Chase far better than I did. I grew up and is born and raised Alaskan, and like many other Alaskans, grew up in a very abusive home. So I was kept away from my family, family that was again stolen from me when Chase was murdered. When I heard about his death, I heard it through the eyes of a mom. My mother told me what happened. I have two sons as well. And the entire family grieves whether I knew Chase as well as the rest of my family or not. But then, close to a month later, I was told that, you know, there was this tag that was pulled. It was for Chase. But there was this ridiculous law that kept my family from being able to hunt in his name and in his honor. And I did what I did best. I bugged a bunch of people on this committee. I sent a lot of emails, and I wanted to know why this was not possible for my family, and what I came to find out, many other bereaved families. Then, you know, through Senator von Imhoff's office, the time and patience of a lot of local officials who were willing to educate me and my family onto why this was an issue, it was very clear that this is a very easy fix as well. I come at this wanting to help my family in a time of so much loss. I think all of us understand what it feels like to have lost something in the last year and a half, whether it was the sense of normalcy, being able to see our family and friends, and in my family's case, being able to comfort our family and friends in a time of grief. But I have seen the resiliency of Alaskans in this moment as well, via a lot of elected officials in this state Senate, which brings me a lot of pride to have been born and raised here. And I have no doubt that this body will do the right thing in passing this very easy, very common sense law that will make sure that no family will feel an unnecessary loss and grief in a time of already unfathomable pain. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and I'll just echo my previous comments to the rest of the family members. Please accept our deepest sympathies for your loss. Next, we'll move on to Aaron Trent. Aaron, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, senators, members of the State of Alaska Senate Resources Committee. My name is Aaron T. Trent, and I'm a lifelong Alaskan living in Anchorage. I was also one of Chase's older brothers. I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 125. If this bill is passed, I believe it will positively impact hundreds, if not thousands, of Alaskans, both physically and emotionally. The moose hunt my late little brother Chase paid for and successfully drew a tag for is the exact unit my father and I harvested our first moose. This would have been Chase's first big game hunt, and he was so excited to join in on the family tradition this year. Chase was known for fighting for injustices and equality, and was the most fair and sharing human being I've ever known. The passing of this bill would honor my little brother's memory and speak volumes for our state and the fine men and women putting in the work day after day to make fairness and justice happen. The passing of this bill would bring a great deal of relief and joy to all the unfortunate families who have been in this sad and unfair situation. It would also prevent immense sadness burdened on the families in the future when they are told, sorry, there's nothing we can do about it. Well, I think we can do something about it, and I think we will. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Aaron. Next, we'll move on to Kelly Trent. Kelly, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Yes. Hi, my name is Kelly Trent. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk. I'm sorry. That was my son. Just a little emotional. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Take your time.
Thank you.
I'm Chase Towerson's mom. I'm sorry, Chief. I did not expect to do this. Chase was my youngest child. He was a dynamic young man. He enjoyed hunting, fishing, and all of the outdoor activities that Alaska offers. Losing Chase has been the worst thing for myself and my family that we've ever gone through. My husband and I were born and raised in Alaska, as well as our six children. We raised our kids here, going out on many adventures in our great state. We went fishing, hunting, camping as a family. And when successful, when we were fishing and hunting, we always then shared any bounty with family and friends. This year, my sons and my husband decided that they were going to make sure they would all be available with time off work to go moose hunting together and all put in for the tags in the same area in hopes one of them would be issued a tag. Chase decided to put in for on his tag. Sorry, he started decided to put in for his tag on December 14th, which was his 26th birthday. He told me it would bring him luck in getting the tag. Within 3 weeks of his birthday, our son Chase was murdered. It was the absolute worst day of my life. One month later, the tags were published, and Chase was right. Putting in on his birthday worked. He was issued a tag. Out of his father and two brothers, he was the only one issued a tag for a moose. When we were told it couldn't be transferred to his father or brothers, I was stunned. I couldn't understand how everything in his estate is ours to handle, but the one and only thing we can't have is his opportunity to get a moose. My family has had very dark days since Chase was murdered, and we'll continue to do have some for quite some time due to having a trial and going through all we're going through. We're never going to get over our loss of Chase. But this hunt would have been a way to honor Chase and help our family towards some type of healing. The meat, if the hunt would have even been successful, would have helped feed his grandparents, his parents, his siblings, and his many nieces and nephews. I realize it is too late for that change to happen for us in this fall hunt, but would like our family to be the last family that this ever has to happen to. Our son Chase always helped others and always believed in righting any wrongs he could. This would be something he would want changed. We have had so much loss, and then to lose his opportunity to help feed his family is terrible. I never want another family to go through this. Something like this is within our power to change, and I do believe that our great state of Alaska and our senators can make that happen for Senate Bill 125. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your willingness to be here. I'm sure it's not easy. We appreciate hearing from you. I know we have Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang online. Commissioner, if I know you're here for a different bill, but I have a question. If we were to offer a conceptual amendment to make this retroactive in committee, would the department be able to issue this tag to this family or whoever else would qualify due to death this year still?
Through the chair, this is Doug Vincent Lang, Commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. If you make the bill retroactive, I'm sure that we could figure out a way to make that happen.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. I have a couple folks left online. I would ask, please, that you try to make your comments as brief as possible. Next, we have Jeff Trent. Jeff, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Senator Rivett, members of the Senate Resources Committee. My wife and I had both prepared statements, so they would sound very similar as we prepared them independently. So I'll pretty much try to cut to it here. I just want to add, of course, I'm very much in support of Senate Bill 125. I just want to add our son Chase was an Alaskan who fully embodied the spirit of Alaska. He owned his own homestead land paid for by his hard-earned wages, 5 undeveloped acres he planned to settle on and eventually retire to. He loved bringing home the wild bounty of Alaska to share with his elders, his family, and others that lacked the ability or opportunity to harvest for themselves. He also was one to stand up and speak out for what he believed, help those less fortunate or able to, and help right wrongs with dogged determination. It is in his spirit that I ask for your support of this bill and to ensure that families in our unfortunate situation can be transferred the tags granted to our loved ones by the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and your careful consideration on this matter.
Thank you, Jeff. And we'll echo again, please accept our sympathies and thanks so much for being here to testify. Next, we'll move on to Mark Richards. Mark, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. I just wanted to say briefly that we support the intent of this legislation. Our condolences go out to the Bowerson family and their friends. I do have a couple of points that I think are important to make about this bill, and I hope the Bowersons are still listening. The first point is that the Board of Game already has the authority under 5AAC 92.050 to transfer certain permits. As a matter of fact, it gives Commissioner Vincent Lang that authority. One of those concerns military combat veterans that have been called to duty after they drew a permit. And as far as that's concerned, the next Board of Game statewide meeting is coming up next year, and the call for proposals doesn't end until the end of May. I would be happy to help the Bowersons in drafting and submitting a proposal to the board to be heard at that next meeting to ask for this to be changed under their authority. And if they were to show up and testify, I believe there's a very good chance the board would pass it, and it might be a faster and easier way to get this done rather than going through the legislature. The second point, the last point I want to make to the sponsor and to the committee is that the Section 2 amendment to 1605-420C, that only applies to locking tags. It doesn't apply to permits. So unless the intent of the bill is to also transfer a locking tag that the deceased winner had already purchased, which would really only apply to some brown bear hunts and muskox hunts, that really doesn't need to be added to the bill. And that's all I have, and I want to thank Senator Von Imhoff for sponsoring this legislation.
Thanks, Mark. Last, we'll go to Teresa Campamore. Teresa, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Hi, this is Teresa Campamore. I've been in Alaska for 42 years. The Bowersons are family. And so when we first got the news of, can you hear me? Oh, there I am.
Yes, please continue. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry. I won't take a whole lot of time. My family spoke very eloquently about Chase and his love for Alaska and how we all love Alaska. I'm sorry. This is just really emotionally. When Kelly got the news of Chase that first night when he was killed, it was a really, really hard time. And then when she got the news that they couldn't transfer the permit either, it's like they relived it all over again. It was just another, like she said, like a punch in the gut. And so I just want to say thank you to all of you for considering all this. Senator Von Imhoff's office has been amazing, and it's been a joint effort for a few months, and I just am really grateful to hear some of the things that I've heard coming out of this, if it even can go retro. So I know you don't have much time, but I'm going to let you go. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Teresa. We really appreciate your willingness to be here and testify. Seeing no more online and none in the room, we're going to close public testimony. So I will say that I have had conversations with folks in the Department of Fish and Game related to game, expressing the need for this legislation. And so just to make sure, while I appreciate the comments related to the board, it is my understanding, based on conversations with the Department of Fish and Game, that this is a necessary fix. And actually, having spoken to the bill sponsor, I would entertain a conceptual amendment if we have one. Mm-hmm. Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I would like to propose a conceptual amendment that states this bill will be retroactive to apply to draw permits awarded for the 2021 hunting season.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the conceptual amendment passes. All right, we have... do we have any other questions about the legislation in front of us, SB 125? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Bill 125, version 32-LS0626-B out of committee with the attached individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes. As amended, conceptual amendment number one.
Thank you. Do we have an objection? Seeing none, SB 125 moves from committee as described. We'll take a brief at ease and pass around the paperwork. Back on the record, the next item on the agenda is SB 113, Extend Fishery Resource Land Tax Credit. I'd like to welcome Senator Olson and his staff, Ken Truitt, to the committee. Please come up and put yourselves on the record and walk us through this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Rivak, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Senate Bill 113 is a bill that extends the sunset date for the Western Alaska Community Development Program to continue their function, which is essential to many of the coastal villages in rural Alaska. The CDQ program is based on the landing tax credit for fish, which in turn provides economic development in Western Alaska. This committee heard and passed out an identical bill last year, SB 184, which was in the Finance Committee when the bodies adjourned because of the pandemic. As such, the program sunset was in 2020. The bill now seeks to revive and extend the program to 2030. Mr. Norm Van Vacker, President and CEO of Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, is with us and ready to speak on the bill. We also have Jennifer Williams and Ragnar Ahlstrom on behalf of the Yukon Delta Fishers Development Association who are ready to speak as well. With that, Mr. Chairman, I can give you either more information or we can have Ken Truitt go through the bill for you.
Sure, we could hand it over to Mr. Truitt, and if you like, Senator Olson.
Thank you. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Senator Olson. Senator Olson described this as a pretty simple bill. Last year it was just a sunset extension bill, but it is identical in form as it was to last year, and it just extends the sunset of this program until December 31st, the year 2030. That's it.
Okay. Do we have questions?
Just seems like a...
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
A pretty simple. It's we have revenue of about $553,000. And it continues to serving its purpose by attracting donations each year to Alaska nonprofit corporations that are dedicated to continually improving our fisheries. This seems like a pretty good bill.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to public testimony. Public testimony on SB 113 is now open. Please limit your remarks to a minute. For those listening online and would like to testify, need your name, who you're with, do you support the bill or not? 1 minute. We'll start with Norman Van Vector. Norm, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Resource Committee, and thank you for scheduling Senate Bill 113 today. This bill would extend the sunset date for the Fisheries Landing Tax Credit for taxpayers like us that harvest fishery resources in the provisions of a community development quota. And for allowing me to speak briefly with you folks today. Special thanks to Senator Olson and his staff, Ken Truitt, as well, for the work they've put into this. For the record, my name is Norman Van Vactor, a resident of Dillingham, and a career-long participant in Alaska's fisheries. I am the president of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, one of the six Alaska CDQ corporations, and BBDC represents 17 coastal communities. The Community Development Program was first established under the Hickel administration in 1992, and codified in the Madison-Stevens Act in 1996. This remarkable program provides Alaska coastal communities along the Bering Sea coast with harvest quotas in the federal water fisheries of the EEZ. The benefits of harvesting this quota are invested in our fisheries, fisheries programs, and regional development programs to provide employment and educational opportunities to our community's residents. The Alaska legislature enacted the Fisheries Resource Landing Tax, I believe, in 1993. The CDQ tax credit provision was first enacted in 2014. Our for-profit fishing partners harvesting our CDQ quota are eligible to participate in the tax credit program. The legislature considered extending the sunset provision last session, as was mentioned, but along with many other bills, failed to advance through the process due to the legislature's early recess. Principally, BBDC relies upon this resource fisheries tax credit program to supplement the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute and our collaborative work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Our efforts are critical in providing stable research funding that directly benefits the state, the region, and the health of the salmon resource. Extending the program through 2030 would provide stability for our long-term planning in the region and further solidifies our collaborative work with EDF&G and other members of the Bristol Bay Collaborative. Again, thanks for the opportunity and all you folks do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Van Vactor. Next, we will move on to Jennifer Williams. Jennifer, please put yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Resource Committee. Thank you for scheduling Senate Bill 113. I'd also like to express thanks to Senator Olson sponsoring the bill and to Ken Truitt for his staff support. My name is Jennifer Williams, a lifelong Alaskan, originally from Emonic, which is located in the Lower Yukon region. I'm currently employed with Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association as the government affairs, the CDQ entity representing six communities of the Yukon River Delta. Our member communities represent more than 3,400 residents who live in one of the most economically challenged regions of the United States. And the CDQ program, you know, it allows us to provide fishery and economic benefits to our resident fishermen, their families, and the entire region. So YDFDA has participated in the Fishery Resource Landing Tax Credit Program since its inception, and we use this program to particularly offset the amounts we spend annually to support fishery research and monitoring studies on the Yukon River. These research projects are developed in collaboration with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and we do our best to employ our residents to conduct and or assist in the data gathering and processing. By way of example, in the 3 years between 2017 and 2019, our harvesting partners were able to realize nearly $303,000 in credits. And as a result of YDFDA's $1.48 million 3-year research expenditure, So the credits greatly assist us to conduct test fishing monitoring activities on the Lower Yukon for Chinook, summer and fall chum species, and to conduct lamprey eel tagging and recovery studies, and to conduct Chinook outmigration and smolt trawl survey studies sponsored in part by National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Both subsistence and commercial openings are predicted on the test fisheries referenced above. And I'd like to say that without this valuable scientific information, ADFNG would be hard-pressed in their Yukon River management efforts, which would likely translate to loss of economic opportunity in the region and our request for additional state dollars. So in short, you know, this tax credit benefit is redirected into our regional fisheries, thereby supporting our resident subsistence and commercial activities. None of the tax credit funding is used for Wide Safety Administration and our management fees. This program is greatly appreciated, properly administered, and we encourage the legislator to extend the sunset date as outlined. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Jennifer. Next, we will go to Heather McCarty. And Heather, please, if you could abbreviate your remarks, we'd greatly appreciate it. Please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the sponsor of the bill. My name is Heather McCarty. I am speaking on behalf of the Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, which is one of the six CDQ groups and the one that works for the benefit of the community of St. Paul in the Pribilof Islands. The community depends on a couple of different fisheries. One is the halibut fishery, the small boat halibut fishery, which is undertaken every summer by the residents, and one is the crab fishery in the Bering Sea. So far, through the life of this program, it has been extremely important to us. We've conducted enormous amounts of research on both halibut and crab, and in addition, we have funded a scholarship program over the last 4 years that provides scholarships to our worthy young people to go to college. We heartily support the extension of this tax credit, and thank you again for the opportunity to show our support.
Thank you, Heather. Looks like the last testifier we have online is Angel Drobnica. Could you please put yourself on the record and begin?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angel Drobnica. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some very brief comments today on behalf of the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, more commonly known as the PICDA. We represent six very remote cultural communities in Southwest Alaska, and we're one of the six CDQ organizations whose mission is to increase direct participation in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Island fisheries and to help develop sustainable fisheries-based economies. Our organization utilizes the revenue generated from our quota holdings and fisheries investments to create jobs, build infrastructure, provide scholarships and workforce training, and help support a wide range of local priority initiatives and projects through grant programs to our eligible community entities. We strongly support SB 113 and the continuation of the Resource Landing Tax Credit Program. Under the program, our harvest partners are providing an opportunity to attribute a portion of their landing tax liability from the harvest of our CDQ quota for specific fisheries investments. This has been a very meaningful program that we've used to advance our mission through supporting training opportunities directed at employment in the seafood industry and to help with shoreside facility improvements. We greatly appreciate Senator Olson's sponsorship with this bill and the committee's work and consideration, and we encourage you to support the advancement of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Angel. Seeing no other testifiers online, we're going to close public testimony. Do we have any other questions from members of the committee? Well, I just want to thank the sponsors, Senator Olson. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great bill. At this point, I would ask, what is the will of the committee? All right. Could we get a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Senate Bill 113, version 32-L-S0719/A, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Seeing none, SB 125 as described moves from committee. We'll sign the paperwork while we still have.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Senate Bill 113.
Forgive me. Thank you for that correction. We will move Senate Bill 113 from committee as described. Thank you for that, Senator Olson. Again, thank you for
Chairman,
this bill.
Thank you very much, and members of the committee, thank you very much as well.
What's next?
We will have an introduction quickly of SB 59, Saltwater Sport Fishing Operators Guides. The first order of business will be to adopt a CS. We'll take a brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. The last item on for today is SB 59, Saltwater Sport Fishing Operators Guides. First order of business today is to adopt a CS that made changes to conform our drafting rules, to conform to our drafting rules, and no substantive changes were made. Could I get a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 59, version 32-GS-1608. /Bravo.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Is there an objection? All right, seeing none, the committee substitute has been adopted. We have Doug Vincent Lang, Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, to start us off. And Commissioner, could you please put yourself on the record and begin?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to SB 59, legislation introduced by the governor and which is a department priority. SB 59 came before this committee last year, but unfortunately, because of the COVID pandemic, it was not acted upon. With this bill, the department would like to reinstate the saltwater licensing and reporting requirements. It does not reinstate the freshwater licensing or reporting requirements because the department does not see an immediate need for this kind of reporting in freshwater at this time, which is what initially caused some contention with this bill. Before I go any further, let me provide you with some legislative background. The sport fish guide and operator licenses were first adopted during the 2003-2004 legislative session and took effect in 2005 and remained in effect through December 31st, 2014, when they expired due to a sunset clause. This legislation was passed based on the urging of both fresh and saltwater guides who were looking to professionalize their industries. During the 2015-2016 legislative session, only the saltwater licensing and reporting requirements were reinstated with a sunset of 2018. The legislature stripped the freshwater piece from the legislation, and the department supported this as we were not using the freshwater information for in-season management or assessment of fisheries. And we were seeing minor logbook violations, for example, an error in the reporting of the number of grayling released results in the loss of concession permits, notably on federal lands. This legislation sunsetted after passage in 2018. The legislature provided some bridge funding through UGF, but it has since gone away. As such, we have no legislation in place to collect fees to pay for the Marine Logbook Program. We are continuing the logbook program, however, it's under a registration program that was adopted to the Alaska Board of Fisheries. Logbook data has been collected by the department from the saltwater sport fishing businesses and guides since 1998 and is critical to upholding the state's U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty obligations, providing data to the International Pacific Halibut Commission crucial to making allocation decisions, and for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council for making fisheries, federal fisheries, or managing federal fisheries, avoiding duplicative reporting mechanisms and undue burden for the charter fishing industry. It is also used by the Board of Fisheries for managing fisheries across Alaska. Let me give you an example of the utility of this information in the management of saltwater fisheries. Last year, we saw significant decreases in tourism to Alaska, which resulted in significant reductions in saltwater charter boat fishing and participation.
We used the data from this logbook program to show that we would be significantly below our quotas for halibut, and we're able to use this data to relax the regulations enacted by the International Pacific Halibut Commission. This resulted in additional opportunity and participation in halibut charter fisheries, much of which was by Alaskans. This provided a needed economic boost to the charter fisheries and to local economies, as well as for putting halibut in the freezers of Alaskans. Fees collected as part of this bill would provide data necessary to manage marine charter fisheries off Alaska. These fisheries support somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 angler days of effort and contribute over $1.5 million to the state's economy. In sum, the department supports this bill and sees it as a necessary tool to fund and manage saltwater charter fisheries. We urge your support in moving this bill out of committee. Thank you. If the committee would like, Ms. Hanke can walk you through a sectional analysis of the bill, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do we have any questions at this time? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Commissioner, for being online. You mentioned that this logbook data has been collected since 1998. How was it funded before, I guess?
Through the chair. So it was first funded through the legislation that licensed freshwater and saltwater guides. However, when that bill sunsetted, it was later introduced as just a saltwater piece, and we had that for about 4 years where the saltwater licensing of guides and operators paid for it. And then after that sunsetted, we received a bit of bridge funding, and now we're just basically using Fish and Game Fund and other money to basically to fund that continuation of that program. So we don't have any dedicated funding like we had in the past for this program any longer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, is there any possibility this applies to the bare boat charters as well?
Through the chair, at the current time, it does not, no.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to Rachel Hanke. Please walk us through the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rachel Hanke, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. Section 1 of the bill establishes the fee schedule for the licenses, the guide license being 200, operator license, and the combined license both being 400. Section 2 adds 1640262, which defines the operator license type and has requirements for that license, such as an Alaska business license and insurance. Section 3 adds 1640272. And this outlines the guide license as well as the combined license and also provides those requirements. Section 4 is 1640282, and this is the logbook section, so it establishes the reporting requirements for the guides and operators. Section 5, 1640292, establishes the penalties for violations of the chapter. Section 6, 1640301, define saltwater sport fishing guide and saltwater sport fishing guide services. Section 7 adds these new license types to Title 25, which defines what a license is. Section 8 is the effective date, January 1, 2022.
Do we have any questions? Okay, any questions for the commissioner or Ms. Sankey? None? Going once. Okay, seeing no further questions, I appreciate everybody who was here with us today in committee or online with us. Thank you for your willingness to be here and to testify. I really appreciate your time. We're going to hold this bill for further consideration. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, April 28th. We'll be hearing SB 85, Forest Land Use Plans, Timber Sales, and SB 121, PFAS Use and Remediation, Fire Water Safety, and SB 104, Geothermal Resources. This meeting is now adjourned at 5:06 p.m.